Welcome to The Honest Report, a weekly podcast analyzing media coverage of the Arab Israeli conflict, anti-Semitism, and radical Islamic terrorism.
Violence escalating between Israel and the Palestinians, hundreds of rockets fired from Gaza toward Israel, people running for cover.
We start the show with the breaking news that has been coming in. Israeli police are saying that at least seven people have been injured in a car ramming and stabbing attack in Tel Aviv.
Hundreds of rockets fired from Gaza towards Israel. People running for cover on this Tel Aviv beach as air defense systems blew rockets out the sky.
Here's your host, Rob Walker.
When exactly did the conflict between Israel and its Arab neighbors begin? Some detractors say that following the Six-Day War in 1967, when Israel gained eastern Jerusalem, Judea, and Samaria, often called the West Bank, among other areas in a defensive war, the conflict truly kicked off. Others say Israel's establishment in 1948 was the genesis. Still, the seeds of the conflict were planted even before that in 1936. That's according to journalist and political analyst Oren Kessler. Kessler's new book, Palestine 1936, The Great Revolt and the Roots of the Middle East Conflict, posit that 1936 was the genesis of conflict between Israel and its Arab neighbors. Kessler has previously served as the Arab Affairs correspondent for the Jerusalem Post, an editor, translator, and writer for the English edition of Haaretz, as well as a research fellow at the Henry Jackson Society think tank in London. He joins us as our guest on this week's podcast. Welcome to The Honest Report. Oren Kessler, welcome to The Honest Report podcast.
Thank you very much, Robert. I'm happy to be here.
The pleasure is all ours. So you've recently written your first ever book, Palestine 1936, The Great Revolt and the Roots of the Middle East Conflict. So first of all, congratulations on this big accomplishment.
Thank you so much.
Second of all, this is, of course, the question that you, I'm sure, are getting a lot, which is, when you ask people, regardless of whether they're supportive of Israel or they're anti-Israel detractors, and you say, what are the most significant dates in the Middle East with respect to Israel and the Arabs, Israel and the Palestinians? You know, some people would say the Six-Day War, 1967, when Israel conquered these lands in the Six-Day War. Some people would say the State of Israel, 1948 or 1947. What is it about 1936 that in your mind really is the kernel of the Middle East conflict as we understand it today?
Well, I wouldn't want to suggest that 1967 were not important, or 1948 for that matter, but there are the bookshelf holding the books that deal with those particular conflicts, I think, are already creaking under their own weight, whereas this particular sort of chapter of the conflict that I wrote about has, for some reason, kind of been mostly passed over and forgotten. And when I started reading about it and researching it, it really struck me that this was a tremendously seminal and formative and decisive period, namely 1936 to 1939, certainly for the Arabs of this country, but equally, arguably even more so for the Jews and for the Zionist movement and for the State of Israel. And for the Middle East conflict, as we call it today, and attempts to resolve that conflict. So it just struck me as a forgotten but extremely formative and important period for all three sides. I suppose for Jews, for Arabs, for the British and the international community. And I'm sure over the next 15 minutes we'll get into why.
So that's a great segue. So tell us about, you know, what happened in 1936 in the British Mandate of Palestine.
So the very, very express version, this book took up about 5 years of my life in terms of research and writing, but the very express version is that I'm sure I don't need to refresh your listeners' memories on the major milestones of Zionist history, namely the Balfour Declaration in 1917, the start of the Mandate in the early 20s. There's the infamous Hebron Massacre of 1929. But my book, really, the immediate backdrop to my book is really in many ways, the rise of Hitler and other anti-Semitic movements in Europe and the resultant spike in Jewish immigration. In the first half of the 1930s, the Jewish population of this land doubles, and it's approaching nearly 30% of the entire population. It's very clear to everyone, including the Arabs who live here, that if things continue this way, the Jews will be a majority before long. So really, that's sort of the backdrop. And then in April 1936, there is what's called what the press of the time calls the Bloody Day in Jaffa, April 19th, 1936, in which 16 Jews are murdered in a spate of attacks in Jaffa and South Tel Aviv. And it becomes, again, fairly evident to all involved that this is a new phase of the conflict. That's how this revolt begins. And it's matched at the very beginning with it begins in violence, but very quickly, the leader of the Arabs of Palestine, a man who your listeners will probably already be familiar with, Haji Amin al-Husseini, declares that the Arabs will be striking and having no contact whatsoever with the British authorities or with the Jews until certain demands are met, chiefly a complete stoppage to Jewish immigration and a complete ban on land sales, because very many prominent Arabs were quite happily selling land at inflated prices to Jews while they were railing against the practice in public. So Haji Amin announces that this strike will continue until those demands are met. And indeed, the strike lasts for 6 months, which is even to this day one of the longest general strikes anywhere in history. And it bears fruit in that the British send the famous Royal Commission, the Peel Commission, to Palestine to examine grievances. So that's really kind of the first phase, the first 6 months of the revolt in a nutshell.
Now, in your research, what were some of the, I mean, you've identified perhaps some of the macro causes of this Arab revolt, but was this you've called it in your book sort of, you know, the first intifada before there was an intifada. Was this something that was truly grassroots, or was it, as we understand the later intifadas to be, much more generated really from a political level?
So much like the subsequent, the more recent intifadas, of course, the first intifada began in 1987. The second intifada began roughly 2000, 2001, 2002, depending on where you start counting. And particularly in the second intifada, in this great Arab revolt of the late 1930s, what happened really was that it began as a kind of spontaneous outburst of violence, and it began as acts of grassroots violence, if you like. And then very quickly, the political leadership, namely Haji Amin, rushed to sort of assert control over it. And then that both the sort of the political demands and ultimately really the violent acts themselves. And as the revolt wears on and grows and starts to rage more fiercely into 1937, particularly 1938, he's really pulling the strings. He's really, Haji Amin and his henchmen are really guiding the revolt along its main lines. And that's the case even after the Mufti flees the country as a wanted man, because the British have determined that he's really, quote unquote, the chief villain of the peace, and as they put it. And so he flees to Lebanon, and yet is able to assert that control even from abroad. And there are clear parallels there to more recently to Yasser Arafat, who, of course, was in many ways, there's pretty compelling evidence that, in fact, he took a lead role in particularly the second intifada. So there are really quite a number of fairly startling parallels between this period, which again is the period I'm writing about is 10 years before there was a state of Israel. And yet I kind of argue in the book that so many facets of the conflict as we know it today really took shape in this period, a decade before Israel's birth.
Now, what were some of the consequences of this Arab revolt as it related to the British government's, you know, mandate control of the land?
Well, so I mentioned the Peel Commission, the Royal Commission that arrives in late 1936. And in the summer of 1937, they release their famous and 400-page long report, which is mostly remembered by history for its last 10 or 12 pages, in which it recommends the drastic solution of partition, a clean cut, as they put it, into two states, one Jewish and one Arab. And this is really the very first two-state solution promulgated by the international power with the most sway over this land, which was the British Empire at the time. This is the first two-state solution proposal. This is the first time that the notion of a Jewish state really appears on the table, on the international agenda in any real way. This isn't merely a Jewish national home, as the Balfour Declaration had promised, but a Jewish state with everything that means. That means control over immigration. That means presumably an army. It's sovereignty. And of course, the Jewish state that was offered was quite small, and nonetheless, it was a state. And so that's clearly one of the most historic legacies of this revolt, certainly from a Jewish perspective. And there was a raucous debate within the yeshuv, within the sort of pre-state Jewish community here, over whether to accept it. But the two leaders whose voices mattered most were David Ben-Gurion, who even at this time was the leader of the yeshuv, and Chaim Weizmann, who was the leader of the World Zionist Organization. And they were both, even as they sort of played coy and maybe yes, maybe no, they both were extremely excited by this prospect of a Jewish state. But the Mufti predictably rejected this proposal. He called it a degradation and a humiliation and an amputation. And it was not long after this proposal was offered that the revolt exploded back. It had been sort of suspended in abeyance while the commission went about its work. And once the Mufti rejected it, it sort of exploded yet again. So that's this two-state solution idea, this Jewish state idea, is clearly one of the most major legacies of this revolt. And if I could just mention two more briefly, especially particularly from a Jewish perspective, this is the period in which the British army, again, I mentioned that the revolt sort of burst forth again and started raging again in mid-1937. And the British had a real problem because they wanted to quell this revolt, of course, but they simply didn't have the manpower to do it. They had the war clouds were gathering over Europe, and they simply couldn't afford to send large army contingents to this corner of empire. So what do? They agree to a longstanding Jewish plea to train and arm Jews in large numbers. That's exactly what happens. So really, 15 or 20,000 Jews are trained and armed by the British. They join something called the Jewish Supernumerary Police.
So 3 years, of course, after this rebellion in 1936, these riots, you had the white paper, the infamous white paper of 1939, which really was a bit of a different approach in terms of, you know, severe limiting of Jewish immigration in Palestine, the preventing of Jews from purchasing Arab land in the vast majority of the mandate. Did the events of 1936 play a role in this British white paper of 1939?
Oh, completely. It was the white paper was a direct result of this revolt, and really, this is probably the third sort of major legacy of this revolt, again, particularly from a Jewish perspective. And this one was, of course, a very negative, extremely negative legacy from a Zionist perspective. Basically, this was the era of appeasement. This was the Neville Chamberlain government. And they, again, were convinced, it was hard to deny at this point, by 1939, that war was likely with Hitler. Even Neville Chamberlain was not necessarily denying it by this point. And they were determined not only to appease fascist Italy and Nazi Germany, but, you know, I've read the cabinet papers, and they use this word appeasement in terms of Arab and Muslim opinion around the empire. They were particularly worried that the large Muslim population of India, if they were angry about Palestine, that they wouldn't be on board with the war effort. And so basically the Chamberlain government decides to drastically change their Palestine policy. And they drastically, dramatically cut Jewish immigration to a grand total of 75,000 over 5 years. And again, this is mid-1939. This is a crucial period for the Jews of Europe. They're desperate to leave. Just as a matter of comparison, in 1935, 60,000 Jews came to Palestine. So now we're talking about 75,000 total over 5 years. And any further immigration would be contingent on Arab consent. And of course, everyone knew that consent would not be forthcoming. So this was really seen as a tremendous betrayal of not just that two-state solution proposed by the Peel Commission, but even the Balfour Declaration itself. And I think it raises one of these tremendous what-ifs. What if this white paper had not been passed in 1939? I think perhaps it's an overstatement to say that 6 million Jews could have been saved and brought to the land of Israel. But I think it was, you know, it was Golda Meir who later said that had there been a Jewish state in 1937, or had the white paper not gone through, that perhaps hundreds of thousands of people could have been saved. And I think that's a plausible reading of history. So it's, these are just tremendously momentous, consequential decisions that are being made in this period as a result of the revolt.
I mean, it's a very sobering, you know, thought. And it really, I think, only reiterates the strangeness that this topic is not as widely known, or the events of 1936 are not considered to be as significant as you've pointed out. Now, in your book, you quote Professor Mustafa Kabhav, Open University of Israel, who has a perspective as to why, in the Palestinian sort of narrative and consciousness, there, you know, sort of the myth of history, if you will, why the events of 1936 are not as, don't play the same role and have the same primacy as the quote-unquote Nakba, the catastrophe of 1948. Why is that?
Well, Professor Kabha argues, and it's hard to disagree, that really, from a Palestinian perspective, the Nakba was a chapter in their history in which they were victimized. They were victimized by the Zionists. They were victimized by their fellow Arabs who didn't save them from the Zionist menace. They were victimized by European imperialism. Whereas dealing with 36 to 39 requires a lot more soul searching, in the words of Professor Kabha, because that initial unity that I mentioned earlier of the revolt and of the strike, really, after the Peel Commission and after the violence explodes again, and after the Mufti flees the country, really that unity really dissolves in a convulsion of Arab infighting and score settling. And I think it's much of it led by the Mufti and his henchmen, but not all of it by any means. And I think it's much harder from a Palestinian perspective to kind of explain to yourself why it is that so many Arabs were shedding Arab blood in this supposed revolt against Zionism. And really, this is just one of the main takeaways and arguments of the book, is that the revolt to crush Zionism really ends up crushing the Arabs themselves, the Arabs of Palestine, and that in many ways the final showdown, the final reckoning between Arabs and Jews that occurred in this land in 47-48 was really won by one side and lost by another nearly 10 years in advance. And you'll notice that today there are no schools named for the Mufti, there are no roads named for the Mufti. You may have soccer stadiums named for various terrorists and militants from the 80s or from the 30s. You know, there are militant leaders from this period who are still celebrated in the Palestinian discourse. The Mufti is greeted with, you know, embarrassed silence, if anything, because the Palestinians realized, I think belatedly, that he had been a disaster for them. The Arabs were economically gutted, militarily. There were thousands of Arabs were killed in this revolt, probably about at least 5,000 Arabs as against 500 Jews, which in itself is a huge number, but a far higher Arab death count, many of them at Arab hands. And just the entire Arab social fabric was just torn, whereas the Jews, led by Ben-Gurion, were really experts at turning adversity into an advantage. And despite that very painful death toll of 500, which we wouldn't see numbers like this until the Second Intifada, but despite that, they made tremendous gains militarily, economically, politically, and just in terms of morale. It really united the Jewish community. So again, in many ways, that showdown between Jews and Arabs, that civil war that occurs here in 47-48, was really won by the Zionists 10 years in advance and lost by the Palestinian Arabs.
Well, Oren Kessler, thank you so much for your time today. And once again, congratulations on your new book, Palestine 1936, The Great Revolt and the Roots of the Middle East Conflict. Thank you again for joining us.
Thank you so much, Robert.
And that's today's edition of the Honest Report podcast. If you haven't done so yet, please subscribe to our mailing list, our podcast channel, and follow us on social media for the most up-to-date news. If you like what you've heard, please consider a donation to support our continued efforts at www.honestreporting.ca/donate. Until next time, thank you so much for listening.